If someone could predict the day you'd die, would you want to know? And how would knowing change your life? That's the premise behind The Immortalists, a new novel from Chloe Benjamin about four siblings whose lives are profoundly shaped by a moment of, well, it could be magic, or it could be something else. The story begins on a hot summer day in 1969. Daniel, who's 13 years old, has heard of a mysterious woman who claims to be able to tell you the day you'll die. And he and his brother and sisters decide to pool their allowance and go see her.
It's this tense, rich moment in American culture. So much is happening the summer of 1969, and the siblings are feeling both left out from that larger cultural moment and kind of shaken by it. They want some knowledge that will ground them. They want something that they can know for sure. So they go to see this woman, and the book then follows each one of them over the next 50 years.
So she tells them their death dates?
She tells them what she claims are their death dates. And that difference is what drove the book. What is the difference between knowledge and expectation, and how do those questions shape our futures?
How did you even come up with this premise? Because it feels so mythic, almost. It's like a classic fairy tale or a Bible story.
Oh,
but,
I love
you know,
that.
Set in the Lower East Side of 1969.
You know, I think some of those big mythic stories were in my bloodstream. I grew up reading what I now think is kind of a golden age of YA. The Golden Compass, the C.S. Lewis books, A Wrinkle in Time. Mm-hmm. And I think all of these really rich, slightly speculative, but really grounded in character books were some of the ones that shaped me. And then I always say also that as much as I wish I had an interesting fortune teller story, this book really just comes out of my own neuroses. I am somebody who really struggles with uncertainty.
How so?
Well, I think uncertainty is so core to human life. We have to put one step in front of the other every day without knowing how long we have in the world. You buy a house, you have children, you get married, all with the supposition that you'll have many decades to enjoy these things, but there's no guarantee.
So I often, most of us manage to suppress that knowledge
just to
get out of bed every day.
Exactly. And I'm like, how do people do that? I have a hard time suppressing it. It's very present for me.
There's a moment after the kids have met with this old woman, and she makes them go inside one at a time and gives them tea and tells them their death date.
It's all very civilized.
Yes. Each of them, when they walk out of that apartment building, they're each shell-shocked. And there's a sense that they're not walking back into the same world. Everything is different.
Mm-hmm. Varya scoots to the edge of her chair and offers her hand to the Rishika, whose own hands are nimble and cool. Can you really do it? She asks. Do you know when I'll die? The woman looks at Varya. Her eyes are bright, black marbles.
I can help you,
she says.
I can do you good.
She turns to Varya's palm, looking first at its general shape, then at the blunt, square fingers. She squeezes the tip of Varya's pinky. What are you looking for? Varya asks.
Your character. Ever heard of Heraclitus?
Varya shakes her head.
Greek philosopher? Character is fate, that's what he said. They're bound up, those two, like brothers and sisters. You want to know the future? Look in the mirror.
The Rishika turns Varya's hand over and sets it down on the table.
January 21st, 2044.
Her voice is matter-of-fact, as if she is stating the temperature or the winner of the ball game.
You got plenty of time.
For a moment, Varya's heart unlatches and lifts. 2044 would make her 88, an altogether decent age to die. Then she pauses. How do you know?
What did I say about you trusting me?
The Rishika raises a furry eyebrow and frowns.
Now, I want you to go home and think about what I said. If you do that, you're going to feel better. But don't tell anybody, all right? What it shows in your hand, what I told you, that's between you and me.
Do you play that out for yourself? Do you ever try to think, what would it be like if you did know the day you were going to die?
I think I play it out less in my own mind about myself than I do about these characters, and that's my way of doing the former, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right that not only do they leave with a changed sense of the world, but they leave in much greater isolation from each other. Instead of being a group, a family, they've become individuals. And instead of being children, I think to some extent this knowledge has made them adults.
Wow. Well, talk about biblical.
That's well,
exactly
yes,
like
I was
Adam
thinking,
and Eve after, you know, the forbidden knowledge and you're exiled from the Garden of Eden, this innocent time of childhood.
Yeah, I think that was definitely in the bloodstream.
Years later, Daniel, the oldest boy, tracks down this fortune teller and he confronts her and says, how could you have done this to us? We were just children. And she says, all children are fascinated by death. Do you think that's true? I mean, were you fascinated by death as a child?
I do think that's true. I think that children haven't learned how to suppress it the way that adults have. And I think that the wonder and joy of the world is very present for them, just as the fear of loss is present for them. I was always an anxious child, and I think some of us are just wired that way. I was very attached to my mom as a young kid. And I remember once asking her very seriously, you know, are you going to die? You know, every child is different, but I do think that kids lack a certain veneer that we gain in adulthood. And that's a protective film that allows us to affect ignorance, even if we aren't actually ignorant.
But that protective film is also what then makes the world prosaic, right? You were talking about loving those wonderful children's and YA books.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I did too. I mean, that's almost all I read. And as a result, I think of my childhood as almost this enchanted time.
Mm.
And I'm aware of how incredibly lucky I am to be able to say that. But I do feel that sense of enchantment, the sense of that the world is potentially a magical place, it's awfully hard to hold on to as an adult. Mm. I most of the time don't feel it.
Yeah.
How about you?
I agree. I mean, I feel it when I come across total mystery, and maybe that's part of what this book is exploring. Since writing the book, I've heard stories from people about their own relationship to death or stories of people they know who predicted correctly their own dates of death. I mean, again,
wow.
Those kinds of things that you just can't explain. And so as much as I crave certainty and knowledge, I also paradoxically find enchantment and magic in what science can't tell us.
Yeah, it's interesting that we want so much to believe that science will be able to explain everything. And at the same time, we don't want to live in that world.
Yes, yes, it's true.
Yeah. You did a ton of research for this book. One of the characters, Clara, develops a really strong interest in stage magic. How did you even do all of that research? You must have uncovered so much that was fun.
That research was so fun. I have no background in stage magic, but I did have a background in the performing arts. And so I think through Clara, I could channel some of the experience of being on stage, the relationship with an audience, and the kind of risk and precarity that comes from performing by yourself.
I have to ask you to read a section from
sure.
that. That's one of my favorite sections in the book.
Okay. So in this scene, Clara is auditioning for the biggest show of her life, and she's trying to convince two very hardened executives at a major Las Vegas casino to give her a chance.
Mind if I use that? Thank you. You're very kind.
She holds the mug in her right hand and splays her left to show them it's empty. When she snaps, a quarter appears between her left thumb and forefinger. She drops it into the mug where it clinks. She pulls two coins from the bald man's shirt collar, one from each of his ears and two from the larger man's shirt pocket.
Now this is your mug, not mine. There's no secret compartment, no storehouse of coins. So I bet you're wondering how I'm doing this. I bet you already have your predictions. You see me producing coins over and over. Well, you assume they must be in my left hand. And when I show you my left hand, when you realize that I can't be holding them there, you change the logic. Now you're thinking they're all in my right hand. It would be useful, wouldn't it? So close to the mug, you can't see that I might...
She passes the mug to her left hand.
...be shifting.
She reveals her right hand, empty.
Methods.
She coughs. Two coins tumble out of her mouth. The dark man puts his pager in his shirt pocket. Now she has his attention.
You're a religious man,
says Clara, eyeing the cross around his neck.
My father was too. But what I've realized, what I think he already knew, is that we believed in the same thing. You could call it a trap door, a hidden compartment, or you could call it God, a placeholder for what we don't know. A space where the impossible becomes possible. When he said the Kiddush or lit the candles on Shabbat, he was doing magic tricks. We know something about reality, my father and I. And I bet you know it too. Is it that reality is too much, too painful, too limited, too restrictive of joy or opportunity? No. I think it's that reality is not enough.
Clara sets the mug on the floor and retrieves a cup and ball from the drawer. She puts the empty cup face down on the table and places the ball on top.
It's not enough to explain what we don't understand. It's not enough to account for the inconsistencies we see and hear and feel.
She opens her fist. The ball has vanished.
It's not enough on which to pin our hopes, our dreams, our faith.
She raises the steel cup to reveal the ball beneath it.
Some magicians say that magic shatters your worldview. But I think magic holds the world together. It's dark matter. It's the glue of reality, the putty that fills the holes between everything we know to be true. And it takes magic to reveal how inadequate.
She puts the cup down.
Reality.
She makes a fist.
Is.
When she opens her fist, the red ball isn't there. What's there is a full, perfect strawberry.
I love that scene so much.
I love your reaction. There's no better gift to a writer.
Oh, when I read that scene, I put the book down and I just thought, wow.
Oh, I love that scene, too, and it was a beast to write. I have very strong memories of agonizing over that and trying to figure out the blocking in theater terms, the philosophy of what she's saying lined up with what she was doing mechanically. So I think that was the tricky part.
But you know what also strikes me about that is you write in such a heartfelt way about that longing, that hunger for magic and mystery and the unexplainable, the thing that makes reality so much bigger. Is writing for you a kind of magic?
That's such a great question. I think it is. I mean, I know it is because of how real these characters feel to me. Now, maybe that just means that I'm crazy, but I really do feel like they're sort of in some parallel universe. And you can cut this out, but sometimes I even have this thought like, yeah, you all died, but the book is impacting people, so you didn't die for nothing, which is crazy.
But it's not. A book is an alternate reality in the sense that you made this whole world and these characters up, and now they live.
And now they exist. I think you're right. It goes back to kind of the power of thoughts. If something feels real, in some ways it is, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a line in the book that one character knows that the narratives she has about her life are stories, but is it a story if you believe it? Once you start to incorporate thoughts into your belief systems, they do become part of
right.
your reality.
Do you believe in fate?
I believe in things that can't be explained. And that is the conclusion that I came to in writing the book when people ask me if I believe that the woman's fortunes were true, that she had this power, or if it was a real strawberry that Clara produces in that magic scene. I don't know myself. And I like to live in that place of debate. So ironically, as much as I struggle with gray areas in real life, I think fiction is the one place that I allow myself to embrace them.
That's Chloe Benjamin. Her new novel is called The Immortalists. And if you want to know more about her, you can read a great profile by our new writer and producer, Shannon Henry Kleiber. You'll find it and more stories by Shannon on our website at ttbook.org.